It is a pleasure for me to introduce someone who most of you know, and of course have seen him so ably conduct throughout this wonderful conference. Professor W. Paul Reeb is someone I've admired since he was a young assistant professor at the University of Utah. Those of us at the Y thought we would one day snatch him from the U, but that has not been the case. He seems to be happy there. Don't ask me why. Still, we keep our eyes on him and are proud of the accomplishments of a former Cougar. And as we all know, once a Cougar, always a Cougar. Right, Paul? For those of you who do not know him as well, a little biography. Paul is the Simmons Professor of Mormon Studies at the University of Utah, where he teaches courses on Utah history, Mormon history, and the history of the U.S. West. His first book, Making Space on the Western Frontier, Mormons, Miners, and Southern Paiutes, published by the University of Illinois Press in 2006, won the Association's, or the MHA's, Smith Pettit Award for Best First Book in 2008. Said one reviewer, this book is deeply thoughtful and offers important perspectives for the present occupiers of this desert land. Another reviewer added, Reeb has furthered frontier studies by expanding beyond single group history to analyze complex three-party interactions. The book should provide a compelling model for future research. His second book, which most of us, I hope, have read, Religion of a Different Color, Race and the Mormon Struggle for Whiteness, published by Oxford University Press in 2015, received the Mormon History Association's Best Book Award, the John Whitmer Historical Association's Smith Pettit Best Book Award, and the Utah State Historical Society's Francis Armstrong Mattson Best History Book Award. In 4 short years, the book has claimed its place as one of those must-read classics in Mormon history. Professor Reeb is also an outstanding teacher. He's the recipient of the Utah Council for Social Studies University Teacher of the Year Award, the University of Utah's Early Career Teaching Award, and the College of Humanities Ramona W. Cannon Award for Teaching Excellence in the Humanities. Professor Reeb's intellectual production has also transcended academic and scholarly borders, as he has written quite eloquently on issues that affect Mormonism, particularly those that deal with race and gender. And he has been interviewed numerous times, as he has become also a must-go expert on church race relations. He's also project manager and general editor of a digital database, Century of Black Mormons, designed to name and identify all African Americans baptized into the faith between 1830 and 1930. This is a monumental effort that is going to impact the writing of the history of Black saints for years to come. His work and his demeanor draw praise from his colleagues in the field and those who know him well. Said one MHA colleague, Paul is a gracious person who is willing to listen, even to a view that he may not have considered before. Said another, when I think of Paul, I think of a first-rate scholar who is completely unassuming and humble. But don't confuse his calm demeanor for passivity. He is not only one of our field's best scholars, but is also exemplary in applying the best tools of historical scholarship to advancing social change and racial equality. Still another, Paul is a patient advisor, unfailing colleague, and an example of how the best scholars balance excellent teaching, exceptional writing, and wise student mentoring. And one more. Someday, when we're the old people in this organization, and some of us are already the old people, The youngsters will think of him the same way we have thought of Richard Bushman or Ron Walker, as an untiring scholar, but also as a kind and attentive mentor and gentleman, end of quote. And I myself would add that at the pinnacle of his career, he will walk the path of those whom we so much admire, like Leonard Arrington, Laura Ulrich, Tom Alexander, Carol Madsen, Jan Shipps, and others, some who sit here with us, and some who have passed on to write history on the other side of the veil. Added one colleague and good friend, and I think this is beautiful. I've known Paul for 26 years, and I still vouch for him. Professor Reeve is also the epitome of a scholar of faith. He is one of those rare people who transcends the institutional and ideological parameters of both his scholarship and his religious tradition to embrace something bigger, which is to know the truth, to recognize the complexity of history, to follow where his scholarly inquisitiveness leads, and to not be dogmatic in either his scholarship or his faith. Empiricism, he once wrote, leads me to the ultimate source of truth, and it is there, at the very margins of what is knowable through rational means, that I fall to my knees and crawl into the darkness, my faith replacing knowledge and sometimes leading me down less traveled roads. My profession, he continues, provides a rational check on my faith. An academic approach to Mormon history brings my understanding of that history into agreement with my professional understanding of history in general. Understanding the nature of those varied perspectives makes my study of the past much less about concrete and immutable facts and much more about capturing a multiplicity of voices. Continues, I attempt to be balanced and to see the past as clearly as possible through the eyes of those who lived it, knowing that one day my own history will be open for review, end of quote. And he hopes, he says, historians will be as balanced and understanding of his history as he has tried to be of others. I think all of us would agree that history and historians will be kind to him as he reflects the best that both the academy and a life of faith can give. Please join me in welcoming Professor W. Paul Reeve to the podium to give his presidential address. Paul.
Thank you, Ignacio. I'm not sure anyone can live up to that, but that was very kind of you and very thoughtful. The 4th of July celebration in Salt Lake City in 1865 was in many ways typical of such 19th century events, filled with flag waving, songs, speeches, a parade over a mile in length, a 13-gun salute. There were elements of that day celebration, however, that were unlike others. Even the anti-Mormon paper, the Union Vedette, called it a great, a grand, a joyous gala day in Salt Lake City. The 1865 event was perhaps most notable for its position in time and space, coming as it did less than 3 months after the Civil War ended and John Wilkes Booth assassinated President Abraham Lincoln. As the Vedette put it, the 4th of July that year carried new significance for a country tried and proved and recently redeemed from threatened national destruction. It was notable, too, for the presence of a national political figure, James M. Ashley, sitting with Mormon leader Brigham Young on the stand at the Bowery on Temple Square. Ashley, a member of the United States House of Representatives from Toledo, Ohio, is best remembered by historians as the Great Impeacher. A significant force in the founding of the Republican Party, he emerged in Congress as an important radical Republican who helped shape his party's policies toward reconstructing the South. By 1865, he had already facilitated congressional passage of the 13th Amendment to the Constitution outlawing slavery and would argue forcefully for constitutional amendments to grant civil rights and suffrage to blacks. Most notably, in 1867, Ashley introduced impeachment proceedings in the House against President Andrew Johnson and led the charge to remove the president from office. Ashley's presence in the West at such a crucial juncture in the nation's history provides a fitting metaphor for the bringing together of regional historical narratives about Reconstruction. As the historian Heather Cox Richardson suggests, Western studies are critically important to our larger understanding of Reconstruction, especially as we learn from the West and tie its lessons into a national story. As Richardson sees it, redefining the era of Reconstruction as an era of citizenship, when Americans defined who would be citizens and what citizenship meant, offers a more inclusive view of the period. At the same time that radical Republicans in Congress moved to expand America's definition of citizenship to include former slaves, they sought to contract that definition to exclude members of one of the 19th century's most maligned religious groups, the Mormons. In doing so, religion became a critical defining element in the radical Republicans' construction of citizenship and held far-reaching implications, in this case, even upon geopolitical boundaries in the West. The story that follows explores the connection between Ashley's ideas for the South and his failed attempt in 1869 to eliminate Utah and redraw the West. It is filled with Ashley's political machinations and the corresponding effort of Mormon leaders to claim citizenship for themselves. They actively sought to shape public opinion in their favor and thereby preserve the geopolitical integrity of Utah Territory. Allegations of corruption, graft, and sexual impropriety also pepper the story. In short, it's a classic political tale, but with important lessons about integrating regional narratives into a more broadly conceived version of Reconstruction. With Ashley as ideological linchpin, a national rather than sectional approach to Reconstruction incorporates religion, Utah, and the broader West more effectively into the longstanding North versus South narrative. For Ashley, the West was a region he viewed no differently than the conquered South, and the South was a region of secessionist states he viewed with more contempt, but no differently than Western territories. He asserted that both regions were subject to federal power and argued for the supremacy of congressional rule in the admission or readmission process. Ashley was born 14th of November, 1824, in Allegheny, Pennsylvania, into a devout Christian home. His father, John Ashley, was passionate about religion and eventually became an itinerant Campbellite preacher, traveling on a circuit which took him through southeastern Ohio, parts of Kentucky, and West Virginia. Ashley, as a young boy, sometimes accompanied his father on his preaching tours and witnessed firsthand the brutalities of slavery. His father's authoritative attitude and the Campbellite church's countenancing of slavery created a rift between father and son that remained with the younger Ashley throughout his life. He could not accept his father's theology, especially its endorsement of slavery, and became alienated from organized religion in general. He maintained a belief in God, and sometime after he married Emma J. Smith in 1851, they both became Unitarians. His upbringing left indelible marks upon Ashley, both in his attitude toward religion and toward slavery. He was determined to eradicate slavery and use his influence to ensure equal treatment for African Americans. He was also determined to pursue a solution to the Mormon problem. Those two ideological views were politically wedded for Ashley in 1856 at the National Convention of the Republican Party, an event he attended as a delegate from Ohio. The party adopted as a plank in its platform the notion that it was, quote, both the right and imperative duty of Congress to prohibit in the territories those twin relics of barbarism, polygamy, and slavery. In doing so, Republicans placed polygamy on par with slavery and labeled it barbaric, an antithesis of civilization which fell outside accepted Protestant marital norms and made its practitioners unfit for democracy. For Ashley, this plank became a central component of his Reconstruction ideology, especially its assertion of congressional power over the territories. The 1856 plank was not a mere rhetorical flourish for him, but a political agenda which he pursued with zeal. His stance against slavery and the Mormons became driving forces during his 10-year service from 1859 to 1869 in Congress. By 1862, with Southern representatives gone, Republicans could pursue their plank against both slavery and polygamy in earnest. Ashley, as chairman of the Committee on Territories, played a role in the passage of two bills, both of which demonstrated congressional authority to legislate for the territories. One of the bills outlawed slavery in the territories, while the other, the Moral Anti-Bigamy Act, was designed to punish and prevent the practice of polygamy there too. Abraham Lincoln signed them both into law. Ashley and his fellow Republicans thereby made good on their 1856 pledge and simultaneously asserted the supremacy of congressional rule over the West. It was a principle that figured prominently in Ashley's Reconstruction plan for the South. During the same Congress that outlawed slavery and polygamy in the territories, Ashley introduced a Reconstruction bill which outlined his views of the rebellious Southern states and their relationship to the federal government. His idea became known as the territorialization theory. As Ashley saw it, rebellion against the Constitution in effect nullified Southern state constitutions and made them subject to Congress, like territories in the West. Upon secession, Ashley believed Southern states passed back into the condition of territories, and as such, the president was authorized to establish temporary civil governments for the former states. Ashley's Reconstruction Bill was far-reaching on other grounds as well. It essentially emancipated slaves in conquered territory, called for the seizure of public land to be held as compensation for loyal citizens, including former slaves, and allowed black men the right to vote and to serve as jurymen. Congress deemed most of these provisions far too radical and tabled the bill in March 1862. Ashley's view of Southern states as territories also meant that he viewed their boundaries as fluid, much as those in the West. His 1862 bill authorized the president to redraw former Confederate state boundaries and rename the former states. Another of Ashley's failed Reconstruction measures, this one introduced in 1867, proposed to transfer a portion of Texas to New Mexico. That gray portion would go to New Mexico. And then divide what was left of Texas into two remaining states. Meanwhile, in the West, under Ashley's leadership and liberal approach to cartography, Congress created several Western territories in the 1860s. The map on the left is what the U.S. West looked like at the beginning of Ashley's tenure in the House. Ashley drew and redrew political boundaries during the 1860s, until Western states and territories looked like the map on the right by the end of his tenure in the House. Ashley's hands were quite literally all over the map of the American West. Then in 1869, Ashley attempted to redraw the West anew. In doing so, his radical Republican answers to Southern Reconstruction spilled over into his approach toward Utah and the Mormons. In the meantime, the Civil War tore the nation asunder, and Ashley spent his energy working for passage of the 13th Amendment, an effort which culminated in success in January 1865. With that victory behind him and the Civil War over, Ashley turned at least some of his attention to his role as chairman of the House Committee on Territories, an endeavor that found him in Salt Lake City on July 4, 1865. For their part, the Mormons did what they could to portray themselves as loyal Americans to their distinguished guest. After a reading of the Declaration of Independence, a band played the Star-Spangled Banner, and George Q. Cannon, then private secretary to Brigham Young, delivered the keynote address. At the invitation of Latter-day Saint leaders, Ashley then took the pulpit. He had arrived at 1:30 that morning and had not anticipated speaking to so large an audience celebrating the nation's freedom. Ashley was polite and complimentary toward the Mormon audience. He told them that the people of this country should feel under great obligations to you and thank them on behalf of the loyal people of the United States for the demonstration which I have witnessed today. He was particularly pleased to hear sentiments uttered to which every true American heart must say amen. The only hint of the Mormon suspect position on the national stage came when Ashley told the crowd that it affords me pleasure to find you conforming to the new condition of things, obeying as best you may the laws under which you are bound to live. Perhaps an allusion to the Moral Anti-Bigamy Act, which Ashley helped to pass. Ashley closed with an explanation for his trip west, telling the crowd that he hoped to know and understand its wants better than he could possibly understand them at a distance. Even Brigham Young seemed satisfied with the day's events. He later reported that the 4th of July celebration was very excellent and passed off remarkably well, and suggested that Ashley was much pleased with the proceedings. If Ashley's actions during the rest of his stay in Salt Lake City are any indication, he was more interested in understanding the wants of the non-Mormon population of Utah than he was that of the Mormons. After the celebration at Temple Square, Ashley spent the rest of the 4th of July at Fort Douglas, the federal military installation on the East Bench overlooking the Salt Lake Valley. He listened to Reverend Norman McLeod, the Army chaplain and an avid critic of Mormonism, give a speech, and Ashley himself addressed the gathering. He spent 9 days in Salt Lake City, most of them with a crowd from Camp Douglas, as swimming in the Great Salt Lake, visiting the offices of the Union Vedette, and speaking to the non-Mormon population. Brigham Young, in fact, left for southern Utah 6 days into Ashley's visit. For Utah, Ashley's 4th of July visit marked a decided shift in his attitude and approach toward the Mormons. His speech to throngs gathered at Temple Square gave little clue to his growing animosity toward a people he increasingly considered religious outsiders. After visiting other states and territories, Ashley returned east. There, he took up the radical Republican banner toward reconstructing the South and simultaneously began laying the groundwork for reconstructing Utah and the West. By early 1866, Ashley held congressional hearings on the condition of Utah, in which Ashley's committee entertained a resolution that sought to repeal the law organizing Utah Territory and proposed dividing its land and population among its surrounding state and territories. This resolution was the first whiff the Mormons would get of the bill Ashley would introduce 3 years later to dismember Utah. In 1866, Ashley's committee failed to agree on a definitive course of action. Committee members did not deem it advisable to divide the territory and annex it to Nevada and the territories adjacent, nor did they favor the establishment of a military government. Those options were, however, entertained, and military districts, of course, would be organized the following year to reconstruct the South. Sacramento Union newspaper made the connection between the two regions explicit in a column picked up by the Union Vedette. As Ashley's committee deliberated the fate of Utah, the article argued that its duties were somewhat akin to those of the Reconstruction Committee in Congress, and asserted that Reconstruction is quite as necessary in the case of the Mormons as it is of the Southern rebels. By 1869, Ashley intended to do just that, reconstruct the Mormons. Ironically, by that time, his constituents in Ohio had become increasingly convinced that Ashley was more concerned about Reconstruction than about his home district of Toledo, and they refused to re-elect him in the 1868 election. He was therefore a lame duck congressman looking for a political post in January 1869 when he introduced a bill to eradicate Utah from the map. Had Ashley's bill passed, this is what the American West would have looked like. Ashley crafted his bill as a deliberate solution to the Mormon question. He took close aim at Mormon political control of Utah Territory and viewed his proposal as the best disposition possible to eradicate the farce of Mormon governance. His plan radically redrew much of the American West as it simultaneously sought to eliminate Utah. The bill reduced Utah Territory by over 62,000 square miles and carved off large sections of land with its accompanying Mormon settlements, which it then distributed among the surrounding state and territories. The objective was to dilute the strength of Mormon political power, especially because Ashley complained Mormons had persistently voted as a unit and, quote, for 15 years defied the government of the United States and for 8 years flagrantly disobeyed its laws. His original goal, he admitted on the floor of the House, was to blot out the territory from the beginning. But fellow committeemen recommended leaving Utah's main population centers intact until, quote, such time as the population of the adjacent territories and state would be able to take care of them and not be overborne by the consolidated vote of that Mormon oligarchy. Once the surrounding state and territories had enough of a non-Mormon population to overpower the main body of Mormons, Ashley expected to obliterate Utah altogether. By the end of January 1869, the same House of Representatives that debated Ashley's bill would vote to pass a constitutional amendment allowing black male suffrage. Congress was clearly grappling with significant questions of national import, some designed to expand the definition of citizenship along racial lines, others designed to contract them along religious lines. The existence of Utah as a geopolitical entity in Mormon control was at the heart of Ashley's bill. In making his case, Ashley suggested that Utah's Mormon population was unfit for admission into the Union. By implication, he asserted that Congress was in control of the definition of citizenship and that Utah and the Mormons did not conform. If Ashley had it his way, quote, no state government would ever be organized with Mormons in the majority, close quote. Upon learning of Ashley's bill, Brigham Young responded with confidence. I really had thought Ashley and the dismemberment of Utah were among the things of the past, Young wrote to Utah's territorial delegate, William H. Hooper. However, it seems the cat will meow, the dog will have its day, and the dog in this instance, feeling his day is short, sets up his last howl preparatory to his last kick. Young counsel Hooper, Ashley is a trumpeter of his own downfall. Let him blow. Take no trouble yourself on his account. Let Ashley and such men whine and fret and froth. They disturb nothing but their own bile, an ejection of which may do Ashley good. Despite this initial bravado, it seems that Hooper and Young were not entirely willing to let Ashley blow unchallenged. Hooper felt confident that even if the bill passed, President Andrew Johnson would veto it. But he nonetheless took the challenge to Mormonism's political and geographic space seriously. Hooper enlisted the aid of several influential business and political leaders. Collis P. Huntington, vice president of the Central Pacific Railroad, lobbied against the bill, likely in consideration of the fact that Mormon workers helped to construct the Transcontinental Railroad, which was then nearing completion. Had Ashley's bill passed, the meeting of the rails would have taken place at Promontory Summit, Nevada, not Utah. Frank Fuller, a dentist, former acting governor of Utah during the Civil War, and friend to Brigham Young, also used his influence in Utah's favor, as did the reformer and well-connected longtime friend of the Mormons, Thomas Kane. However, Hooper's main avenue of defense was public opinion, and he aggressively sought to shape it in Utah's favor. Hooper engaged in the manipulation of public opinion, a method the Mormons had used previously during the Utah War, and would return to later in an effort to pave the way for statehood. The press I have had to grease to either keep still or publish if I deem it necessary, Hooper wrote to Young in January 1869. A splendid article of two columns appeared in the Cincinnati Gazette. The correspondent is a friend of mine, Hooper explained. Hooper also noted a visit to the press in Chicago on his way to Washington, D.C., and added, if consistent with your feelings, I think it would be wisdom to place some funds to my credit. I find money makes the mayor go. In a follow-up letter to Young, Hooper noted that he had spent money on the press, which I hope may prove all right. He also spoke of reports favorable to the Mormons appearing in the New York World, the New York Herald, the New York Times, and the Cincinnati Gazette. One in the Chicago Republican, however, he called vindictive against us. In February, Hooper again reported, I have been handling the press, and it must be continued. And to do so, I must have money. And with it, I will, I think, light the country into a blaze on the subject of admission, and thus manufacture public opinion sufficient to sandal all the tender-footed congressmen. How much money it will take to keep matters moving along cautiously and wisely, I cannot say, but no large sum. Brigham Young responded to these suggestions with a preference to trust in the Lord, but still sent money in case the Lord needed the help. Enclosed, please find my draft for $5,000, payable to your order, which you are at liberty to prudently use if, in your judgment, good can be accomplished thereby, Young wrote. But my feelings are to trust in the Lord and that our enemies will not be suffered to work the injury to Israel that they design. I forward it, however, for your disposal in case it is apparently necessary. How much Hooper spent, which newspapers he silenced, and which articles he can claim credit for is not known, but the press coverage of the bill was impressive. The Mormon-owned Deseret News led out with an article titled "An Infamous Bill," in which it suggested that poor Ashley of Ohio has had another attack of Utah on the brain, and claimed that these attacks are periodical with him. It recalled Ashley's 1865 visit to Utah and his 4th of July speech, and suggested that the introduction of the bill is the method which he takes to thank us. It ended calling Ashley a needy, unprincipled adventurer, a blatant demagogue, and a political trickster. The Cincinnati Daily Gazette from Ashley's home state was more balanced in its approach. It declared, "There is no public affair in which there is a better need for Congress to go slow and deliberate fully than in the Mormon question." It noted that Mormons defended polygamy by the scriptures and claim religious liberty to protect it. The dividing of such a people is no trifling affair, it argued, and suggested that Ashley's bill treated the Mormons as outcasts, having no rights that the nation is bound to respect, and to be divided up as the Hebrews were divided among their captors. It closed by suggesting that Congress exercise forbearance and allow the Transcontinental Railroad time to work in bringing a new population to Utah before it executes a capital penalty upon it. The New York World similarly called polygamy a religious and a moral issue and argued that radical Republicans, quote, would do well to let the morals of the country and even of the Mormons alone. The New York Times also opposed the bill. It called it a great wrong and questioned the justice behind it. The Times' key point, however, effectively turned Ashley's argument on its head. It suggested that Ashley's bill would in fact facilitate Mormon political dominance throughout the West rather than diminish it in Utah. Should Ashley's bill succeed, the Mormons would be left, quote, holding the balance of power, if not an absolute majority of the votes, in the states and territories between which they are to be thus summarily divided. And working always in harmony, they will practically control the political complexion of Nevada, Wyoming, and Colorado, as well as the narrow belt which the bill leaves to the territory of Utah. Close quote. In reality, no one at the time knew exactly which towns would be transferred from Utah. There were a few Mormon settlements founded by 1869 which would have been encompassed by Nevada's proposed boundaries on the west and Colorado's on the east. Nevada would have received Cedar City and St. George and a few other southern Utah towns, while Glenwood, Salina, and the new Indian agency at White Rocks would have gone to Colorado. None of these towns had large enough populations in 1869 to change the political makeup of Nevada or Colorado. Wyoming's small territorial population of 9,118 in 1870 might have had to worry, however, about the absorption of Logan, Ogden, and Brigham City with a combined population of 6,199 in 1870. Those three towns alone would have increased the population of Wyoming by two-thirds and could have changed territorial politics there. Absent such knowledge and without nuance, the New York Times argument found traction in other newspapers and led to wild speculation about the potential harmful effects of transferring the Mormon problem elsewhere. Colorado, for example, weighed in on the bill. In Utah, there are not less than 150,000 inhabitants, about 19/20 of whom are Mormons, one Colorado newspaper responded. Of these, we should get 80,000. Which would probably place the Mormons in the ascendant so that they would control the lawmaking power and remove the capital to Salt Lake. It will virtually be Mormonizing Colorado. Apparently, Colorado's former governor, John Evans, agreed. Though anxious for more territory, he decidedly objects to having so much Mormons in his ends. The governor protests that as the general government could not manage and control Mormonism, it is decidedly unfair to impose the whole of it upon Colorado. Remarkably, like Colorado, newspapers in the state and territories most directly targeted by the bill expressed opposition, although not out of sympathy for Mormonism. Most papers were in favor of solving the Mormon problem, but did not view Ashley's proposal as effective. In Wyoming, the Cheyenne Argus suggested that, however repugnant Mormonism may be to most of the people outside of its practices, we must yet remember the Mormons have done more good than evil in the U.S. It urged Congress to let Utah remain intact. The Carson City, Nevada Daily Appeal considered the bill's intent laudable as far as it was directed against polygamy and the temporal and spiritual power of Brigham Young, but nonetheless questioned partition as the best method to attack those problems. It suggested that natural forces would transform Utah much more effectively than dividing its land. It predicted that when Brigham Young died, quote, Mormondom will fall to pieces by the weight of its own inherent weakness anyway. As for increasing the size of Nevada, it concluded, we have already territory enough and to spare. The Montana Post similarly favored the bill's purposes, but not its method. If the object is to prevent the further growth and development of that absolute despotism known as Mormonism, the project of Mr. Ashley is inadequate to the purpose. It is merely circumscribing the area, not affecting the power. It suggested that the bill's weakness was that it did not go far enough and prodded Congress to assert its authority. It argued that if it were ever necessary to dismember Utah, the government should, quote, hew to the line, not just skim around the edges. Even still, the Post believed that education and the presence of American people among the Mormons were the best solutions to the Mormon problem. Quote, bestiality will yield to virtue and intelligence, it reasoned, and the coming railroad would infuse Mormonism with, quote, influences that will appeal to the priest-ridden, tithe-oppressed, and unhappily ignorant Mormon masses. In short, it concluded that Ashley's bill is not a remedy for the ills that Mormon flesh is heir to. The Idaho Statesman was more neutral in regard to Mormonism and was likely motivated by the fact that the proposed boundaries diminished Idaho in favor of Wyoming. The Statesman's frustration was further immersed in a broader anger at politicians in Washington, D.C. over their neglect and ignorance of the West. It complained that the Committee on Territories is composed of men who, with one or two exceptions, never saw a territory, much less lived in one long enough to appreciate its peculiar necessities. It did acknowledge that Ashley traveled west in 1865, but then protested that he only stopped, quote, long enough at the way stations to procure a meal and possibly a drink. Based upon the limited information that he could obtain in that carpetbag way, it grumbled that he was not now trying to become the great territorial reformer. All things are to be made anew. It charged Ashley with using the bill to bring his name into notoriety and suggested that if he accomplished no more for the territories than he did for the southern states, the harder he works, the less he will have. Even though newspapers overwhelmingly opposed Ashley's bill, they did so in a way that revealed strong animosity against Mormonism and placed its adherents well outside prevailing notions of citizenship. Several of the editorials used language that described Mormons in contradistinction to American people or citizens, as if the two categories were mutually exclusive. Nowhere was this message expressed more virulently than in the Chicago Republican. Polygamy is a crime against society, an infamous trespass upon civilization, it began. It asserted that Utah territory has long been an almost insufferable stench in the nostrils of the American people. It was not merely polygamy that smelled, but allegiance to a despotic religion above allegiance to country. It smacked of the same misguided devotion that characterized the defeated South and placed Mormons on par with former rebels. As the Chicago Republican saw it, and this is my all-time favorite quote about Utah, Utah is like some carcass of a decaying horse, hauled out of sight and smell, putrefying in the sun, bloated with corrupt gases, swarming with animalcule of death, and assailing with an insufferable stench the nostrils of all who unadvisedly venture into the affected neighborhood. We should alert the Travel Council that we have a new slogan for Utah. Despite such vivid animosity, the Republicans still opposed Ashley's plan. Like several other newspapers, it looked to the Transcontinental Railroad as the effectual exterminator of Mormonism And those of you who were at David Walker's talk yesterday morning, remember his death knell thesis, and it is being repeated here. So the railroad represented permanent contact with the tide of civilization, a force that Mormons would not be able to withstand. The result would be the face gradual crumble into ruins, a process more palatable to the newspaper than Ashley's harried scheme. So in the middle of this public relations war, Hooper and the Mormons had plans to introduce a memorial arguing for the admission of Utah as a state, but felt it unwise to do so while Utah's very existence hung in the balance. If I win, and win it must be, then I will change from the defensive to the attacking party and charge for admission, Hooper wrote Young. By February, Hooper's confidence in the failure of Ashley's bill increased. He believed that Ashley did not have enough votes in the House for the measure to pass, but noted that Ashley had persuaded Senator James W. Nye from Nevada to introduce the bill in the Senate with the hope that Senate favor would strengthen resolve in the House. Emboldened by Ashley's struggle to gain support, Hooper suggested that Ashley was trying to see how big an ass he could make of himself. Clearly overly optimistic, Hooper then added, "I have made up my mind in demanding a vote upon the bill, as there can be no doubt of the result. This attained, and the House has pledged itself fully against dismemberment and must then take the alternative, which I believe they are nearly ready to do, to admit us in and thus give us our rights." However, just because Congress was reluctant to eradicate Utah, it did not mean that it was ready to admit it as a state into the Union. On February 25th, Hooper was allowed to give a speech in the House on the dismemberment bill, an opportunity which he used to assert Mormon rights to citizenship and inclusion. He portrayed the Mormons as the true bearers of progress, agriculture, and civilization into an inhospitable West, and characterized Ashley's bill as yet another measure designed to oppress the Mormons. It was, according to Hooper, an act of official injustice, monstrous in its design and mischievous in its consequences. Hooper reminded Congress that the blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church, and questioned if this republic was prepared to institute oppressive measures against her own citizens for the purpose of driving them weeping from her soil. The portion of Hooper's argument that likely gained more traction, however, was by then a familiar theme repeated in the newspaper coverage of the bill across the nation. It centered upon the approaching Transcontinental Railroad as a force that would transform the Mormons into acceptable citizens, a line of reasoning that Hooper used to his advantage. He pointed to the fact that Ashley's bill would cut Utah off from the very railroad the Mormons helped to build, and wondered if Congress was afraid to allow a direct contact between their own civilization and that of Utah. It was a question that by implication suggested that Ashley's bill would prevent the railroad from having its predicted civilizing impact, and therefore challenge the bill's overall efficacy. Hooper also took aim at what he called a legislative earthquake shaking loose the geopolitical borders of the American West. He called Ashley's proposed boundaries a wholesale mutilation of the map and argued that the bill cuts and mangles Utah territory to diminish its size to the point of insignificance. It transferred its citizens without consent to other political entities, sold like serfs with the soil they till. He refused to believe that such a bill, so foreign to the character of the American people, could pass until he heard the vote counted and the result announced. It was a roll call Hooper did not have to endure. Ashley's bill died on the floor of the House without coming to a vote, a rather anticlimactic end to a somewhat tense 2 months for the Mormons. Without a vote, it is difficult to gauge the bill's level of support, nor is it possible to fully assess congressional willingness to contemplate Utah statehood, especially as members of the 40th Congress focused their energy upon passage of the 15th Amendment to the Constitution. Nevertheless, federal officials repeatedly indicated over the next 2.5 decades that Utah's reconstruction was not yet complete. Utah was forced to wait until the Mormons had abandoned polygamy and adopted the national two-party political system before it was admitted as a state in 1896. James Ashley was absent from that protracted struggle, and without him, Congress never returned to a geographic solution to the Mormon question, even though the idea was contemplated on future occasions. Meanwhile, Ashley's political career spiraled unceremoniously into oblivion. As Brigham Young so bluntly put it, Ashley's 1869 bill marked his last howl preparatory to his last kick. He had fallen from favor in Congress, and public opinion turned against him. Ashley's opponents saw political opportunism bound up in his effort to reconstruct the West, while the Mormons viewed it as the punishment of a choleric spleen. Mormon leader George A. Smith believed Ashley's motive was revenge for the Mormons not providing him a woman to sleep with when he visited Salt Lake City in 1865. So in a letter to Hooper, George A. Smith expressed this belief. Ashley communicated his desire for female companionship, according to Smith, to a city alderman and Mormon bishop, Elijah F. Sheets. Smith wondered if things might have turned out differently had Ashley made his request of someone less pious than the worthy bishop. As Smith put it, it is too bad that the ignorance of an alderman concerning what was required to entertain the chairman of the Committee on Territories should entail such fearful consequences. Hooper agreed with Smith's assessment and concluded, "Oh, Ashley is a dog, and I think at least hope that this step will prove the last nail in his coffin." Other sources, however, suggested that it was the pursuit of political power and personal wealth that motivated Ashley. His bill not only diminished Utah, but enlarged the states of Nevada, Minnesota, and Nebraska, and the territories of Colorado, Montana, and Wyoming. As a result, the Cincinnati Commercial announced that territorial governorships are in great demand by Ohio politicians. James M. Ashley is registered for one of them, Wyoming, I believe, by most of the Republican members of the House. The New York Herald wondered about political ambition and land speculation involved in the bill and its potential to cheaply enrich this or that speculator at the expense of the Mormons. The New York Times charged that Ashley's disguised intent was to use the bill for political gain, to secure the early admission of Montana as a state in the Union and a couple of seats in the Senate of the United States to eager aspirants. Similarly, the Baltimore Gazette argued that Ashley's bill was designed to facilitate his political cravings and suggested that Ashley has already arranged to be appointed governor of an enlarged Montana territory. Whether prearranged or not, upon the expiration of Ashley's term in the House, President Ulysses S. Grant appointed him governor of Montana. By that time, however, Ashley's radicalism had cost him dearly in the Senate, and a heated debate ensued over his confirmation. Senate Democrats voted unanimously against him, as did a number of prominent Republicans. In the end, he won confirmation as governor of Montana Territory by only one vote. The New York Times claimed its earlier prediction regarding Ashley's political game had come true. It believed that his appointment signaled the desire to use Montana as a springboard back into Congress. If we do not hear of Senator Ashley of Montana one of these days, it will not be his fault, the newspaper prodded. This time, however, the Times proved less prophetic. Ashley clashed severely with pro-Southern Democrats in his new post as governor of Montana Territory. He held the governorship for only 1 year when Grant removed him from office. So in conclusion then, when James M. Ashley sat next to Brigham Young under the Bowery on Temple Square in Salt Lake City on the 4th of July, 1865, the nation stood at an important crossroads. The Civil War had just ended and Lincoln had been assassinated. The challenge of restoring the Union loomed large and would involve the entire nation, North, South, and West. No single person better embodies the convergence of those geographic regions in the Reconstruction era than does Congressman Ashley. Ashley's efforts also highlight the simultaneous nature of Republican Reconstruction, intent upon forcing both the South and the Mormons to conform to congressional rule. The 1856 Republican Party platform denounced the twin relics of barbarism and became clear ideology for Ashley. He was present for the platform's creation and voted in 1862 for its fulfillment. With polygamy and slavery outlawed in the territories, Ashley then took aim at Mormon political power. In doing so, religion joined race to become a critical defining element in Reconstruction politics. This era of citizenship included significant efforts to expand the definition of what it meant to be an American to include formerly enslaved people, even as it contracted that definition to exclude the Mormons. Thank you.